Esther chapter 7 for me, did a lot of reviewing of Esther 6, went to a bunch of Proverbs to help show that the story, how it relates to the Proverbs that have been written and how they correlate. You're going to get some more Proverbs tonight as we do go into chapter 8. But in chapter 7, we did find that Esther reveals to King Ahasuerus that Haman is an enemy, that he had evil plot, and at the end, what did we see? We've seen Haman hung on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. I was going to go ahead and read chapter 7, but I think I've got enough that I don't want to get too much more into rehashing what has already been taught. But that is where we were left off, where Haman was hung. And so we know from what we've studied so far that the people showed, even though it's not mentioned in the book of Esther, God is not mentioned, we see that the people sought out, that's an Arkansas word, and I'm not from Arkansas. Sorry, anyone from Arkansas. Sorry, Steph. Yeah, sought out God during their distress. God took care of them. God is faithful to the righteous, and we're going to see more of his faithfulness to his people in chapter 8. So if you would, flip over to Esther chapter 8, starting in verse 1. On that day, King Ahasuerus gave the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, to Queen Esther. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had disclosed what he was to her. And the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken away from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. So what do we know about Haman? What was Haman's intent in life, pretty much? What did we see? What type of person was Haman? Very proud. Out for the glory. Yeah, these are some of the attributes you've seen of Haman. We've seen him as being, and Brent hit it pretty hard last week. He had you guys go over to James chapter 1. Haman was also quick to anger, wasn't he? What did his anger do? It caused him to want to hang Mordecai. Because he let his anger quickly respond. He sought out advice from his wife and the advisors. A lot of evil and a lot of hate. And so we know, if we go back to Proverbs 15, we'll see a couple things that Solomon wrote in regards to some of the things that we've seen in Haman. Proverbs 15:9 says, "The way of the wicked is an abomination to the Lord, but he loves him who pursues righteousness." So what's an abomination? Against, disgusted, completely detest, wants nothing to do with, something that he despises. Those are other words that could be used. This is an abomination to God. So the way of the wicked is an abomination to the Lord. Look at Proverbs 15:18. "A hot-tempered man stirs up strife, but the slow to anger pacifies contention." So what lessons learned there? Use your words wisely, but what's it specifically here, though? A hot-tempered man, slow to anger. Yeah, be slow to anger. We're starting to see that, right? A hot-tempered man stirs up strife. Proverbs 15:26. Evil plans are an abomination to the Lord, but pleasant words are pure. So here again, evil is an abomination to the Lord. Proverbs 6, verses 16 through 19. There are six things which the Lord hates, yes, seven which are an abomination to him. Haughty eyes, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that run rapidly to evil, a false witness who utters lies, and one who spreads strife among brothers. Now, how many of those different things did you see in the life of Haman, and those things that God detests, the things that are an abomination? Yeah, pretty much all of them, don't we? We see that he had a lying tongue. Remember, he told King Ahasuerus, what? That there was a people that did not follow your laws, and these people must be destroyed. He made it the whole nation when he was angry at Mordecai. He wanted to destroy all the Jews, so he had the lying tongue. He had haughty eyes. Haughty eyes in what sense? Yeah, I'd say this is more like when I think of haughty, and Carrie, correct me if I'm wrong, but I would think of this more of like covetous eyes, greedy eyes, eyes that want something that is not yours. When I think of haughty eyes, arrogance comes with that. A heart that devises wicked plans, hands that shed innocent blood, feet that run rapidly to evil, goes right to his wife, wants to hang Mordecai. Again, the false witness who utters lies. So, yeah, we're seeing pretty much all these. This is an abomination to the Lord. So how should we as Christians see what God does? I mean, there's a lesson to be learned. How did God address those things he hates in this story? And he did. He addressed it, didn't he? He did not let Haman succeed in the way that Haman wanted to. Now, did he allow Haman to succeed to a point? Yeah, man, to the world's standards, Haman was very successful, wasn't he? But it turned just like that. God's in control of all things. Sometimes we forget that. Sometimes we see the wicked things and we see wicked people succeed in life, go far in life. I mean, I think of our government. Look at how many of them we would say has really succeeded in life in the world's standards, and how many of them have done it through wicked things, though, and how much wickedness do we see even in our own government at times and stuff, the lying tongues and the haughtiness, and know that God's got all that under his control, though. And how often do we let that wrap us up in our lives and kind of cause anxiety and stress and frustration in our own lives? Because we forget God's got it all under control. It's going to be done on his time. He'll take care of things in his time. And so we need to remember that. But all that Haman went after, what happens to it in the end here in chapter 8, verses 1 and 2? Where did it go to? Went to Mordecai, the man who seeked righteousness, the man who is pleasing to God. God's going to take care of his righteous. God will punish the wicked. God will take care of the righteous. Sometimes we just forget that. And sometimes we just feel like, well, why isn't things going as well for me? Why isn't God giving me these things that I see others have in life? And it's easy to get caught up in that. Huh? Yes, he will reward us, won't he, for our righteousness. Sometimes, though, we put it into the earthly things, too. There's more to it, though, because where's our reward? In heaven. So don't get caught up if you don't have all the things that you see everyone else has in life. It's another thing that's easy to do. But here we just seen that God took care of it. God has control over all that's going to happen. Don't seek the things of this world, because in the end, It's going to disappear. That's a good way to put it. He did give Haman enough rope to hang himself. And it happened. So, yes, I think that's just a quick lesson to learn just in those, what we've learned so far in these first two verses. Don't seek the things after this world. Know that God will bless those that are righteous, that seek righteousness. Verse 3. Then Esther spoke again to the king, fell at his feet, wept, and implored him to avert the evil scheme of Haman the Agagite and his plot which he devised against the Jews. And the king extended the golden scepter to Esther. So Esther arose and stood before the king. So what have we learned about Esther so far when she approaches the king? She finds favor. She's what? Humble. And she's still humble. We're seeing it again. There again, when Brent had you read James, what was the other thing? Slow to anger, slow to speak, quick to listen. And what did it say in verse 20, though, of James chapter 1? For anger does not achieve the righteousness of God. So what if Esther, how could have Esther approached all this? She could have. Yeah, so we see her in her whole attitude, because Brent also had you read Proverbs 15:1, which says a gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. She could have approached this whole thing differently, couldn't she? She could have went in there. Yes, Ken. I think you are. No. Yeah. But what did we see out of Esther in the first time she went to the king? She was willing to give her own life, right? For the people. I mean, she was willing to say, here's my life. She knew that that was it. But like we said, a gentle answer turns away wrath. So if she would have went in harsh. Well, even, but where do we learn that behavior? Where do we learn that we have to be louder, boisterous, that we have to be the wheel that squeaks? We've learned that from the world, right? Is that not how the world teaches us? I mean, we see protest. We see all this anger that comes about from protest. We see lots of things happen when we don't do it God's way. And she did it God's way. She did it with a soft approach. She did it with a soft answer. She did not go harshly, because she could have said, King Ahasuerus, wait, you were the one that appointed Haman. You were the one that gave him your signet ring. It was you that sent out the decree throughout the land. She could approach this a whole different way, but she realized there was, I got lots of hands, so, I'll first get to Judy. Judy, you had your hand up first. Right. Yes, exactly. Yes. Right. I agree. And as Judy said, I mean, this Esther knew that, because she even said to Mordecai that, I can't just come if the king does not call me. I can't just come to his presence. And if I do and he does not hand out the golden scepter, then it's my life. And so she knew all that, and she still went. And so I agree. I believe that she was brave. I think she showed some faith. She knew God had it. Richard. Yes. Yes, there's another good point, that Queen Vashti was removed. And yes, and we're going to see that, exactly, and we're going to see that as she, as we go further into there, her plea and stuff. And Chuck? Yes. Right. I mean, you can, that's where you can go to Proverbs 16:18 and stuff. Pride goes before destruction, and haughtiness before stumbling. So, Ms. Karen. Yes. And how many times, even in our own lives, do we recognize God put us in a position for a reason? We're here for a certain reason. Do you see yourself as that, or do we make excuses why we don't do, or we don't allow God to use us as Esther allowed God to use her? She did put her faith into him, and she was able to do things that were pretty extraordinary. I mean, just going to the king, showing humbleness and respect, and yet willing to give her own life in the whole time. I mean, God can use us in the same way. Sometimes we elevate these stories and put people, but what if we told your life story? When people say, oh, Karen, you were put in this spot for this very reason, how would you respond? Would we be kind of like Esther at first of, well, you know, the king, there's this rule, I can't, and start, and we use the things of this world to prevent us from doing what we're supposed to, and then someone challenges us, do we step up, or do we step back? So Esther could have, the whole story could have been completely different if Esther would have handled things a little differently. And we need to look at our own lives, and how are we when we come to a call, and we see something, do we step up? She could have. Yes, she could have sat quietly. And this whole story could have been different. And so look at that in your own lives too and realize that God will take care of the righteous. If you're seeking righteousness, God will take care of you. And sometimes it means you got to step out on faith. You got to believe that God's going to take care of us. I think too often we get caught up in with the things that we see, the things that we hear around us, and we let that influence us and keeps us from doing what God's called us to do. And we're not doing what God calls us to do, then we're just as evil as Haman. Because it's still evil. And evil is evil. And we may not be doing the exact same things as Haman, but do we look at that? But sin is evil. We're not doing what's pleasing to God. We're not seeking righteousness, and we're seeking our own devices, our own success in life, that we're going after things that God hasn't called us to. Could it be just as evil as Haman? I don't see anywhere in the Bible where we see the abominations, but sin is sin. We're not trying to please God, we're sinning. And we have to recognize that. And so are you seeking righteousness? Are you trying to please God? And are you allowing Him to use you as He needs to? Because we've seen that Mordecai also had a time, did the Jews need to repent? Did we see that the Jews, because we knew why are the Jews in slavery in the first place? Disobedience to God. They needed to repent. God let a lot of stuff happen during that time, didn't He? And finally, the Jews came, those that were the remnant came back, or stayed faithful to Him. The remnant stayed faithful. God took care of them in the end. Chuck. Yeah. And that should always keep us soft-hearted. Exactly. We should be soft-hearted. We should always be repentant. We should recognize the faults that we have. We can't go back. You can't change it. So we move forward. And we seek the righteousness. And we keep growing in our faith. Yeah. And if I live in anger, a life of anger, and then I'm quick to anger, and I mean, we just read some of the Proverbs, a hot-tempered man stirs up strife, the way of the wicked is abomination to the Lord, went over some of the different abominations with Him. Yeah, we can't, if those are the way lives we're living, we're not going to be pleasing the Lord, and the Lord can't use us to do righteousness. Right. Yes, because we're actually, as we get further into this chapter, you're going to see how the Jews react to things also affects others. And we're going to see that here at the end of chapter 8. All right. So we see that Esther goes ahead. She's weeping. She's imploring him to avert the scheme, evil scheme of Haman. The king extends a scepter to Queen Esther. She arises, stands before the king. Verse 5. Then she said, "If it pleases the king, and if I have found favor before him, and the matter seems proper to the king, and I am pleasing in his sight, let it be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, which he wrote to destroy the Jews who are in all the king's provinces. For how can I endure to see the calamity which shall befall my people, and how can I endure to see the destruction of my kindred?" So King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther and to Mordecai the Jew, "Behold, I have given the house of Haman to Esther, and him they have hanged on the gallows because he had stretched out his hands against the Jews." So what's her plea? What was her plea in this? To revoke the letter. What? How's King Ahasuerus respond in this first part of it, in verse 7? "I've already taken care of Haman. I've hung him on the gallows because he stretched out his hands against the Jews. I've gave you his house." Verse 8. Now you write to the Jews. This again is King Ahasuerus talking to Esther and Mordecai. Now you write to the Jews as you see fit in the king's name, and seal it with the king's signet ring, for a decree which is written in the name of the king and sealed with the king's signet ring may not be revoked. So that decree, it went out, that had his signet ring, cannot be revoked. When the king's law was set and it was written, it was the law. And it could not be revoked. Even the king could not revoke his law. So what did he allow Esther and Mordecai to do? Write a new law. Write a new decree. You take care of this. Here's my signet ring. I will enforce it. Use it. You write another law. Let's flip back over to Esther 3 and see again, so we're reminded, before we go into what Mordecai writes, let's be reminded of what Haman wrote in his. Chapter 3, verse 13. And letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to seize their possessions as plunder. So that was Haman's writing, that go ahead, destroy, annihilate, kill, plunder, it's all yours with the Jews on the 13th day of the 12th month. Verse 9, back in chapter 8. Chapter 8, verse 9. So the king's scribes were called at that time in the third month, this is the month Sivan, on the 23rd day, and it was written according to all that Mordecai commanded to the Jews, the satraps, the governors, and the princes of the provinces, which extended from India to Ethiopia, 127 provinces, to every province according to its script, and to every people according to their language, as well as to Jews according to their script and their language. And he wrote in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed it with the king's signet ring, and sent letters by couriers on horses riding on steeds sired by the royal stud. In them, the king granted the Jews who were in each and every city the right to assemble and to defend their lives, to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate the entire army of any people or province which might attack them, including children and women, and to plunder their spoil, on one day in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, the 13th day of the 12th month, that is the month of Adar. So what do you see the difference between the decree written by Haman and the decree written by Mordecai? We see some similarities, a lot of similarities. Huh? How's it completely opposite? Okay. Okay, so we're seeing now Mordecai's thing is, we're doing it to defend ourselves. So Haman's was just complete evil, wasn't it? It was a scheme of evil. This is a way to annihilate, to destroy, to kill all the Jews in all the provinces. Mordecai's was, well, we're going to give the Jews the right to assemble and to defend themselves. They still can kill and annihilate and destroy their enemies, but they weren't trying to kill off a whole nation. And we're gonna see some changes that happen here at the end. So, yes, it's different. Mordecai's was more of, yes, Richard. Yes. Yeah, that is true. So And it would be more, it was more of a defense though. Theirs was all, if women and children are coming after you, if there's armies coming after you, you have the right to defend yourself against any of them, to kill them, to destroy them, to annihilate them, anyone that comes after you. Mordecai did not say go after your enemies. It was those that came after you. You have the right to defend yourself now. You have the right to assemble, defend yourself. And you can kill anyone that comes after you. And once you do, you have the right to plunder. You're going to see how they react in chapter 9, but we won't get there tonight in chapter 9. All right, so a copy of the, verse 12. So verse 13. A copy of the edict to be issued as law in each and every province was published to all the people so that Jews should be ready for this day to avenge themselves on their enemies. The couriers hastened and impelled by the king's command, went out riding on the royal steeds, and the decree was given out in Susa, the capital. Then Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal robes of blue and white, with a large crown of gold and a garment of fine linen and purple, and the city of Susa shouted and rejoiced. For the Jews there was light and gladness and joy and honor. So now, after all this happens, why would this reaction be done in the city of Susa when Mordecai comes out? So, but what was their reaction when they seen Mordecai? Mordecai comes out with, there was ecstatic, right? I mean, there was light and gladness and joy and honor. What did that represent to them? Yeah, look, the king has even honored Mordecai, the one that would not bow down to Haman, the one that would not show honor and homage to, is the one that the king has now put a golden crown on his head. He has dressed him in fine linen. It's almost a sign of victory, as Ray said. It's a, almost like a rally cry, right? Look, the king's even got our back. He put this Jew that Haman hated, that wrote the edict, and put him at this level, and they see it, and it causes light and gladness and joy and honor in the Jews at Susa. There's parallelisms that go on with this, I think even in the spiritual world. When the Israelites were first established, what did God create? What did God create right as He established the Israelite nation? A law, right? There was a law that was created. And what did that law do? What does the old law do? What was the purpose of the old law? Teaches right from wrong. Exposes sin. Where do you hear, where do you learn that from? Romans chapter 3. Flip over to Romans 3. Romans 3, and we'll start at verse 19. Now we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law, that every mouth may be closed and all the world may become accountable to God. Because by the works of the law, no flesh will be justified in His sight. For through the law comes the knowledge of sin. So there's where, that's what the law did. It gave us the knowledge of sin. When Haman, or Mordecai, writes a new law, what did it do? It brought joy, it brought excitement, It brought light. These were the different things that we've seen in Esther. When God created a new law, which was when? When was the new covenant, the second law, written? Jesus died and was raised again. Right? And there was a new law. Well, how much joy and excitement and all that do people see in us? How excited do we get realizing that we're no longer held to the old law, to the law of sin, to the thing that gave us and showed us what sin was? There was freedom from that. And so there's kind of some parallelism. Did God revoke the old law? He fulfilled it. And actually, if you go to verse 31 of chapter 3 of Romans, do we then nullify the law through faith? Actually, I should go up a little further because we need to know what the law of faith is. Let's go back to 27, read through. Where then is boasting? Is it excluded? By what kind of law? Of works? No, but by a law of faith. For we maintain that a man is justified by faith apart from works of the law. Or is God the God of Jews only? Is he not the God of Gentiles also? Yes, of Gentiles also. Since indeed God who will justify the circumcised by faith and the uncircumcised through faith is one. Do we then nullify the law through faith? May it never be. On the contrary, we establish the law. So what's he saying there? Just because we're under the new law of faith, does that nullify our works through the old law that were exposed? No, we should be making them fully aware to people, right? We should. Does God still want us to murder? Does not want us to murder? God still does not want us to lie? God still does not want us to steal? Are those things gone? Has God changed on those things? Because in Matthew, I mean, Jesus even hits it further and goes to the heart. Says, wait, now you need to be looking at your heart. And so we start to see this law, Mordecai's law, compared to Haman's law. Haman's law was condemning them to death. Mordecai's law gave them hope, gave them light, gave them a way of escape. Did God not also do that through his laws? The first law would condemn us. The law of faith, through Jesus Christ, saves us. Gives us a way of escape. And so you see some parallelisms in there and stuff. And so I thought that'd be good to point out that. And then so just to finish up this chapter of Esther, chapter 8. Verse 17, and in each and every province and in each and every city, wherever the king's commandment and his decree arrived, there was gladness and joy for the Jews, a feast and a holiday. And many among the peoples of the land became Jews, for the dread of the Jews had fallen on them. So now we're seeing that there's feasts, there's holidays being created because of this. They're excited. How excited are we that Christ saved us? How do we, or do we have that same excitement? I don't like the word used in the New American here for at the end where it says, and many among the peoples of the land became Jews, for the dread of the Jews had fallen on them. My New King James, my NIV, it has, for the fear of the Jews had fallen on them. What was the fear of the Jews? Were they afraid? Was this the fear that they're talking? What was the fear of the Jews? Huh? God's behind them. They had a faith in God. Pretty sure, because the writer has never mentioned God in this, that's why he doesn't say that they had feared the Lord, the God of the Jews. I don't think there's going to mention God in this, but for the fear of the Jews had fallen on them. They seen something about the Jews. What did they see? They've seen the excitement. They've seen the joy. They've seen all this, and people converted to the fear of the Jews. People wanted that. How many people see that type in our life? How many people say, I want what Mark has? I want that joy. I want that, what were the different words? Sorry, gladness. I want that light. Do these people see that in me? Do people say, that's what I want? And so we need to look at how are we reacting? How does the world see us? Are we letting people see that light? And I did have in Romans chapter 2, it does talk about, I can't remember what verse it was. I know it's Romans 2, 26 through 29. It does say, If therefore the uncircumcised man keeps the requirements of the law, will not his uncircumcision be regarded as circumcision? And will not he who is physically uncircumcised, if he keeps the law, will he not judge you? Though having the letter of the law and circumcision are a transgressor of the law. For he is not a Jew who is one outwardly, neither is circumcision that which is outward in the flesh. But he is a Jew who is one inwardly, and circumcision that which is of the heart, by the Spirit, not by the letter, and his praise is not from men, but from God. So we see right there, Paul's addressing the same way. People that are Jews, but they're not Jews. They're not Jews outwardly, but they're people of God. And their praise comes from God, not from man. I think that's what we're seeing here in Esther as well. It's the same thing. So I appreciate your guys' attention, and Lord willing, we will study Esther chapter 9 next week.